Chapter 5. The Hotel Occidental. On reaching the hotel, Carl was at once conducted to a sort of office in which the manageress, with a notebook in her hand, was dictating a letter to a young stenographer sitting at a typewriter. The consummately precise dictation, the controlled and buoyant tapping of the keys raced onto the ticking, noticeable only now and then, of a clock standing against the wall, whose hands pointed to almost 11:30. "There!" said the manageress, shutting the notebook. The stenographer jumped up and put the lid on the typewriter without taking her eyes from Carl during these mechanical actions. She looked like a schoolgirl still. Her overall was neatly ironed, even pleated at the shoulders. Her hair was piled up high, and it was a little surprising, after noting these details, to see the gravity of her face. After making a bow, first to the manageress, then to Carl, she left the room, and Carl involuntarily flung a questioning glance at the manageress.
"It's splendid that you've come after all," said the manageress. "And what about your friends?"
"I haven't brought them with me," said Carl.
"They'll be moving on very early in the morning, I suppose,"
said the manageress, as if to explain the matter to herself.
"But mustn't she think that in that case I'll have a start early, too?"
Carl asked himself. And so he said, to put an end to all misunderstanding, "We parted on bad terms." The manageress seemed to construe this as excellent news.
"So then you're free?" she said.
"Yes, I'm free," said Carl, and nothing seemed more worthless than his freedom.
"Listen, would you like to take a job here at the hotel?" asked the manageress.
"Very much," said Carl,
"but I have terribly little experience. For instance, I can't even use a typewriter."
"That's not very important," said the manageress.
"You'd be given only a small job to begin with, and it would be your business to work your way up by diligence and attentiveness. But in any case, I think it would be better and wiser for you to settle down somewhere, instead of wandering about like this. I don't think you're made for that kind of thing."
"My uncle would subscribe to that too," Carl told himself, nodding in agreement. At the same time, he reminded himself that though the manageress had shown some concern for him, he had not yet introduced himself.
"Please forgive me," he said, "for not having introduced myself before. My name is Carl Rossmann."
"You're German, aren't you?"
"Yes," said Carl. "I haven't been long in America."
"Where do you come from?"
"From Prague, in Bohemia," said Carl.
"Just think of that!" cried the manageress in English with a strong German inflection, almost flinging her hands in the air.
"Then we're compatriots, for my name is Gretel Mittelbach, and I come from Vienna, and I know Prague quite well. I worked for 1/2 year in the Golden Goose, in Wenzelschloss Square. Only think of that!"
"When was that?" asked Carl.
"Many, many years now."
"The old Golden Goose," said Carl, "was pulled down 2 years ago."
"Well, well,"
said the manageress, quite absorbed in her thoughts of past days. But all at once, becoming animated again, she seized both Carl's hands and cried,
"Now that you turned out to be a compatriot of mine, you mustn't go away on any account. You mustn't offend me by doing that. How'd you like, for instance, to be a lift boy? Just say the word and it's done. You've seen something of this country. You realize that it isn't very easy to get such posts, for there's the best start in life that you can think of. You come in contact with all the hotel guests. People are always seeing you and giving you little errands to do. In short, every day you have the chance to better yourself. I'll fix everything up to you. Leave it to me."
"I should like quite well to be a lift boy," said Carl after a slight pause. It would be very foolish to have scruples about accepting a post as lift boy because of his high school education. Here in America, he had much more cause to be ashamed of his high school. Besides, Carl had always admired lift boys. He thought them very ornamental.
"Isn't the knowledge of languages required?" he asked next.
"You speak German and perfectly good English. That's quite enough." "I've learned English in only the last 2.5 months in America," said Carl, for he thought he had better not conceal his one merit.
"That's a sufficient recommendation in itself," said the manageress. "When I think of the difficulties that I had with my English, of course that's 30 years now. I was thinking about it only yesterday, for yesterday was my 50th birthday,"
and she smilingly tried to read Carl's face the impression which such a dignified age made upon him.
"Then I wish you much happiness," said Carl. "Well, it always comes in useful," said she,
shaking Carl's hand and looking a little melancholy over the old German phrase which had come quite naturally to the tip of her tongue.
"But I am keeping you here," she cried all at once, "and you must be tired. We can talk over everything much better tomorrow. My pleasure in meeting a countryman has made me forget everything else. Come, I'll show you your room.
I have one more favor to beg, said Carl, glancing at the telephone which stood on the table.
It's possible that tomorrow morning these one-time friends of mine may bring me a photograph which I urgently need. Would you be so kind as to telephone the porter to send the men up to me or else call me down?
Certainly, said the manageress.
But wouldn't it do if they gave him the photograph? What photograph is it, may I ask?
It's the photograph of my parents, said Carl.
No, I must speak to the men myself.
The manageress said nothing further and telephoned the order to the porter's office, giving 536 as the number of Carl's room. They then went through a door facing the entrance door and along a short passage, where a small lift boy was leaning against the railing of a lift fast asleep.
We can work it ourselves, said the manageress softly, ushering Carl into the lift. A working day from 10 to 12 hours is really rather much for a boy like that, she added,
while they ascended. But America's a strange country. Take this boy, for instance. He came here only a half year ago with his parents. He's an Italian. At the moment, he looks like if he simply wouldn't be able to stand the work. His face has fallen away to nothing, and he goes to sleep on the job, although he's naturally a very willing lad. But let him go on working here or anywhere else in America for another 6 months, and he'll be able to take it all in his stride. And in another 5 years, he'll be a strong man. I could spend hours telling you about such cases. You're not one of them, for you're a strong lad already. You're 17, aren't you?
I'll be 16 next month, replied Carl.
Not even 16, said the manageress. Then you don't need to worry.
At the top of the building, she led Carl to a room which, being a garret, had a sloping wall, but was lit by 2 electric lamps and looked most inviting.
"Don't be surprised at the furnishings," said the manageress, "for this isn't a hotel room, but one of my rooms. I have 3 of them, so that you won't disturb me in the least. I'll lock the connecting doors, and you'll be quite private. Tomorrow, as a new hotel employee, you will, of course, be given your own room. If your friends had come with you, I would have put you all in the large attic where the hotel servants sleep. But as you are alone, I think you would be better here, so you'll have nothing but a sofa to lie on. And now sleep well and gather your strength for work. Tomorrow it won't be so very hard."
"Thank you very much indeed for your kindness."
"Wait,"
she said, stopping by the door.
"I'll have to keep you from being awakened too early."
And she went to a side door opening out to a room, knocked on it, and cried,
"Therese!"
"Yes, madame,"
replied the voice of the typist.
"When you waken me in the morning, go round by the passage. There's a guest sleeping in this room. He's dead tired."
She smiled at Carl while saying this.
"Do you understand?"
"Yes, madame."
"Well, then, good night."
"Good night."
"I have slept," said the manageress in explanation, "very badly for several years. I have every right to be satisfied with my present position, and don't really need to worry. But all my earlier worries must be taking it out on me now, and keeping me from sleeping. If I fall asleep by 3 in the morning, I can count myself lucky. But as I have to be at my post at 5, or 5:30 at the latest, I have to be wakened, and very gently wakened, to prevent me from turning more nervous than I am already. And so Therese wakens me. But now I've really told you everything there is to tell, and I'm not away yet. Good night."
And in spite of her bulk, she almost flitted out of the room. Carl was looking forward to his sleep, for the day had taken a great deal out of him, and more comfortable quarters for a long, unbroken sleep he could not wish for. The room was certainly not intended for a bedroom. It was rather the manageress' living room, or more exactly, reception room, and a washstand had been specifically put into it for his use that night, yet he did not feel like an intruder, but only that he was being well looked after. His box was there all right, waiting for him, and certainly had not been so safe for a long time. On a low chest of drawers, over which a large meshed woolen cover had been flung, several framed photographs were standing. In making his round of the room, Carl stopped to look at them. They were nearly all old photographs, mostly of girls in old-fashioned, uncomfortable clothes, a small high-crowned hat insecurely perched on each head and the right hand resting on the handle of a sunshade. Girls who stood facing the spectator and yet refused to meet his eyes. Among the photographs of the men, Carl was particularly struck by a young soldier who had laid his cap on a table and was standing erect with a thatch of wild black hair and a look of suppressed but arrogant amusement. Someone had retouched the buttons on his uniform with dots of gold paint. All these photographs probably came from Europe, and by turning them over it would be possible to make sure, yet Carl did not want to lay a finger upon them. He would have liked to set up the photograph of his parents in the room he was going to have, just like these photographs here. He was stretching himself on the sofa and looking forward to his sleep after washing himself thoroughly from head to foot, which he had taken care to do as quietly as possible on account of the girl next door, when he thought he heard a low knock at the door. He could not make out at once which door it was. It might as well have been some random noise. Nor was it repeated at once, and he was half asleep by the time it came again. But now it was unmistakably a knock, and it came from the door of the typist's room. Carl tiptoed to the door and asked so softly that, even if the girl in the next room were sleeping after all, it could not waken her. "Do you want anything?" At once the reply came in an equally soft voice.
"Won't you open the door? The key is on your side."
"Certainly," said Carl, "only I must put on some clothes first."
There was a slight pause, then the girl said,
"You don't need to do that. Unlock the door and go back to bed again. I'll wait for a little."
"Good," said Carl, and did as she had suggested, except that he switched on the electric light as well. "I'm in bed now," he said then, somewhat more loudly.
Then the typist emerged from her desk room, fully dressed as she had left the office. Apparently she had not even thought of going to bed.
"Please excuse me,"
she said, drooping a little before Carl's sofa,
"and please don't tell on me. I won't disturb you for long. I know you're dead tired."
"I am not all that tired," said Carl,
"but maybe it might have been better if I'd put on some clothes."
He had to lie quite flat to keep himself covered to the neck, for he had no nightshirt.
"I'll only stay a minute,"
she said, looking about for a chair.
"May I sit beside the sofa?"
Carl nodded. She set her chair so close to the sofa that Carl had to squeeze against the wall to look up at her. She had a round, regularly formed face, except that the brow looked unusually high, but that might have been an effect from the way her hair was done, which did not quite suit her well. Her dress was very clean and neat. In her left hand she was crushing a handkerchief.
"Are you going to stay here long?" she asked.
"It isn't quite settled yet," replied Carl, "but I think I'm going to stay."
"That would be splendid,"
she said, passing the handkerchief over her face,
"for I feel so lonely here."
"I'm surprised at that," said Carl. "The manageress is very kind to you, isn't she? She doesn't treat you like an employee at all. I actually thought that you were a relation of hers."
"Oh, no," she said. "My name is Therese Birchold. I come from Pomerania."
Carl introduced himself. At that, she looked him full in the face for the first time, as if he had become a little more strange to her by mentioning his name. They were both silent for a while. Then she said,
"You mustn't think that I'm ungrateful. If it weren't for the manageress, I'd be in a much worse state. I used to be a kitchen maid here in the hotel, and in a great danger of being dismissed too, for I wasn't equal to the heavy work. They expect a lot from you here. A month ago, a kitchen maid simply fainted under the strain and had to lie up in a hospital for 14 days. And I'm not very strong. I was often ill as a child, and so I've been slow in catching up. You would never think, would you, that I'm 18? But I'm getting stronger now."
"The work here must be very tiring," said Carl. "I saw a lift boy downstairs standing sleeping on his feet."
"The lift boys have the best of it, all the same," she said. "They make quite a lot in tips, and in spite of that, they don't have to work nearly so hard as the girls in the kitchen. But for once in my life, I was really lucky. For one day the manageress needed a girl to arrange the table napkins for a banquet, and she sent down for a kitchen maid. Now there are about 50 kitchen maids here, and I just happened to be handy. Well, I gave her great satisfaction, for I have always been very good at arranging table napkins, and so from that day she kept me with her and trained me by stages till I became her secretary, and I've learned a great deal."
"Is there so much writing to be done here, then?" asked Carl.
"Oh, a great deal," she replied. "More than you would imagine. You saw yourself that I was working up 11:30 tonight, and that's quite usual. Of course, I don't type all the time, for I do a lot of errands in the town as well."
"What's the name of this town?" asked Carl.
"Don't you know?" she said. "Ramses."
"Is it the big town?" asked Carl.
"Very big," she replied. "I don't enjoy visiting it, but wouldn't you really like to go to sleep now?"
"No, no," said Carl. "You haven't told me yet why you came to see me."
"Because I have no one to talk to. I'm not complaining, but there's really no one, and it makes me happy to find someone at last who will let me talk. I saw you below in the saloon. I was just coming to fetch the manageress when she took you off to the storeroom.
That saloon is a terrible place, said Carl.
I didn't even notice it these days, she replied, but I only wanted to say that the manageress is as kind to me as if she were my mother. Yet there's too great a difference between our positions for me to speak freely to her. I used to have good friends among the kitchen maids, but they've all left here long ago, and I scarcely know the new girls. And besides, it often seems to me that the work I'm doing now is a greater strain than what I had before, that I don't even do it so well as the other, and that the manageress keeps me on merely out of charity. After all, it really needs a better education than I have had to be a secretary. It's a sin to say it, but often and often I feel like it's driving me out of my mind. For God's sake,
she burst out, speaking out much more rapidly and hastily, touching Carl's shoulder, since he kept his hands below the blankets.
Don't tell the manageress a word of this, or else I'm really done for. If besides worrying her by my work, I were to cause her an actual pain as well, that would really be too much.
Of course I won't tell her anything, replied Carl.
Then that's all right, she said, and you must go on staying here. I'd be glad if you would, and if you would like, we could be friends. As soon as I saw you, I felt I could trust you, and yet, you see how wicked I am. I was afraid, too, that the manageress might make you her secretary in my place and dismiss me. It took me a long time, sitting by myself next door, while you were below in the office, to straighten it all out in my mind until I saw that it might be actually a good thing if you were to take over my work, for you certainly would understand it better. If you didn't want to do the errands in the town, I could keep that job for myself. But apart from that, I would certainly be much more use in the kitchen, especially as I'm stronger now than I used to be.
Of course. It's all settled already, said Carl. I'm going to be a lift boy, and you're going to go on being secretary. But if you even hint at these plans of yours to the manageress, I'll tell her all you've told me tonight, sorry as I would be to do it.
Carl's tone alarmed Therese so greatly that she flung herself down beside the sofa, weeping and hiding her face in the bedclothes.
Oh, I shan't tell, said Carl, but you mustn't say anything either.
Now he could not help coming a little out from under his coverings, and stroked her arm softly, but he did not find the right words to say and could only reflect that this girl's life was a bitter one. Finally, he comforted her so far that she grew ashamed of her weeping, looked at him gratefully, advised him to sleep long next morning, and promised, if she could find time, to come up at 8 o'clock and waken him.
You are so clever at waking people, said Carl.
Yes, some things I can do, she said, ran her hand softly over the bedclothes in farewell, and rushed off to her room.
Next day, Carl insisted on beginning work at once, although the manageress wanted him to take the day off and have a look around the town. He told her frankly that he would have plenty of opportunities for sightseeing later, but that for the moment the most important thing for him was to take a start with his job, for he had already broken off one career in Europe for no purpose, and was now beginning again as a lift boy at an age when his contemporaries, if they were ambitious, had every expectation of being promoted to more responsible work. It was right and needful for him to begin as a lift boy, but equally needful for him to advance with extra rapidity. In these circumstances, he would take no pleasure at all in strolling idly through Ramsay's. He would not even consent to go for a short walk with Therese when she suggested it. He could not rid his mind of the idea that if he did not work hard, he might sink as low as Delmarsh and Robinson. The hotel tailor fitted him for a lift boy's uniform, which was resplendent enough with gold buttons and gold braid, but made him shudder a little when he put it on, for under the arms particularly the short jacket was cold, stiff, and incurably damp with the sweat of many boys who had worn it before him. The jacket had to be altered for Carl, especially over the chest, since none of the 10 spare jackets would even meet upon him. Yet in spite of the stitching that needed to be done, and although the master tailor seemed to be exacting in his standards, twice he pitched in the uniform back into the workshop after it was apparently finished. The fitting was completed in barely 5 minutes, and Carl left the tailor's room already clad in closely fitting trousers and a jacket which, in spite of the master tailor's categorical assurances to the contrary, was very tight indeed, and tempted Carl to indulge in breathing exercises, for he wanted to see if it was still possible to breathe at all. Then he reported to the head waiter, under whose direction he was to be, a slender, handsome man with a big nose, who might as well have been in the 40s. The head waiter had no time to exchange even a word with him, and simply rang for a lift boy, who chanced to be the very one that Carl had seen yesterday. The head waiter called him only by his first name, Giacomo, but it took Carl some time to identify the name, for in the English pronunciation it was unrecognizable.
The boy was instructed to show Carl all the duties of a lift boy, but he was so shy and hasty that, little as was actually to be known, Carl could scarcely make out that little from him. No doubt Giacomo was annoyed, too, because he had been removed from the lift service, apparently on Carl's account, and had been assigned to help the chambermaids, which seemed degrading in his eyes because of certain experiences, which, however, he did not divulge. Carl's deepest disappointment was the discovery that a lift boy had nothing to do with the machinery of the lift, but to set it in motion by simply pressing a button, while all repairs were done exclusively by the mechanics belonging to the hotel. For example, in spite of half a year's service on the lift, Giacomo had never seen with his own eyes either the dynamo in the cellar or the inner mechanism of the lift, although, as he said himself, that would have delighted him. Indeed, the work was monotonous, and the 12-hour shift, alternately by day and night, were so exhausting that, according to Giacomo, one simply could not bear it if one did not sleep on one's feet for a few minutes now and then. Carl made no comment, but he was perfectly aware that the very trick had cost Giacomo his post. Carl was very pleased that the lift he had to attend was reserved for the upper floors, since he would not have to deal with the wealthy guests, who were the most exacting. Still, he would not learn so much as at the other lifts, and it was good only for a beginning. After the very first week, he realized that he was quite equal to the job. The brasswork in his lift was most brightly polished of all. None of the 30 other lifts had anything to compare with it, and it might have well been still brighter if the other boys who had partnered him had come anywhere near him in thoroughness, and had not felt confirmed in his negligence by Carl's strict attention to duty. He was a Native American of the name Rennell, a conceited youth with dark eyes and smooth, somewhat hollow cheeks. He had an elegant suit of his own, which he wore on his free evenings, when he hurried off to the town faintly smelling of perfume. Now and then he would even ask Carl to take his duty of an evening, saying that he had been called away on family business and paying little heed to the contradiction between such pretexts and his festive appearance. All the same, Carl liked him quite well and was pleased to see Rennell stopping beside the lift in his fine suit before going out on one of these evenings, making his excuses again while he pulled on his gloves, and then stalking off along the corridor. Besides, Carl thought it only natural that he should oblige an older colleague in this way at the start, and he had no intention of making it a permanent arrangement. For running the lift up and down was tiring enough in itself, and especially during the evening there was almost no respite from it. So Carl also learned how to make the quick, low bow which was expected of lift boys, and to accept his tips with lightning speed. They vanished into his waistcoat pocket, and no one could have told from his expression whether they were big or small. For ladies, he opened the door with a little air of gallantry and swung himself into the lift slowly after them, since in their anxiety about their hats, dresses, and fal-lals, they took a longer time than men to get inside. While working the lift, he stood close beside the door, since that seemed the most unobtrusive place, and with his back to his passengers, holding the door lever in his hand so that he was ready the instant they arrived to slide the door sideways without delaying or startling them. Only seldom did anyone tap him on the shoulder during a journey to ask some little piece of information. Then he would turn around smartly, as if he had been expecting the request, and give the answer in a loud voice. Often, particularly after the theaters or the arrival of certain express trains, there was such a rush, in spite of the numerous lifts, that as soon as he had departed one set of passengers on the top floor, he had to fly back again for those who were waiting below. It was possible, by pulling on a wire cable which passed through the lift, to increase its ordinary speed, though this was forbidden by the regulations and was also supposed to be dangerous, so Carl never did it while he was carrying passengers, but as soon as he had them unloaded upstairs and was returning for more, he had no scruples at all and hauled on the cable with a strong, rhythmical heaves like a sailor. Besides, he knew that the other lift boys did it as well, and he did not want to lose his passengers to them. Individual guests who had been staying in the hotel for quite a long time, a common habit here, showed occasionally by a smile that they recognized Carl as their lift boy. These marks of kindness Carl accepted gravely but with gratitude. Sometimes, if he were not so rushed as usual, he could take on little errands as well, fetching some trifle or other which a guest had forgotten in his room and did not want the trouble of going up for. Then Carl would soar aloft all by himself in the lift, which seemed peculiarly his own at such times, enter the strange room where curious things which he had never seen before were lying about or hanging on clothes pegs, smell the characteristic odor of some unfamiliar soap or perfume or toothpaste, and hurry back, not lingering even a moment with the required object, though he usually got the vaguest instructions for finding it. He often regretted that he could not go on longer errands, which were reserved for special attendants and message boys equipped with bicycles, even with motor bicycles. The utmost he could do was to undertake commissions to the dining room or to the gambling rooms. After a 12-hour shift, coming off duty at 6 o'clock in the evening for 3 days, and for the next three at 6 o'clock in the morning, he was so weary that he went straight to bed without heeding anyone. His bed was in the lift boy's dormitory. The manageress, who turned out to be not quite so influential as he had thought on the first evening, had indeed tried to get him a room for himself, and might even have succeeded in doing so, but when Carl saw what difficulties it caused and that she had to keep ringing up his immediate superior, the busy head waiter, on his account, he refused it and convinced her of the sincerity of his refusal by telling her that he did not want to make the other boys jealous through receiving a privilege which he had not really earned. As a quiet place to sleep in, the dormitory certainly left much to be desired, for each boy had his own timetable for eating, sleeping, recreation, and incidental services during his free 12 hours, so that the place was always in a turmoil. Some would be lying asleep with blankets pulled over their ears to deaden noises, and if one of them were roused, he would yell with such fury about the din made by the rest that all the other sleepers, no matter how soundly they slept, were bound to be waken up. Almost every boy had a pipe, which was indulged in as a sort of luxury, and Carl got himself one too, and soon acquired a taste for it. Now, smoking was, of course, forbidden on duty, and the consequence was that in the dormitory everyone smoked if he was not actually asleep. As a result, each bed stood in its own smoke cloud, and the whole room was enveloped in a general haze. Although the majority agreed in principle that light should be kept burning only at the end of the room during the night, it was impossible to enforce this. Had the suggestion been carried out, those who wanted to sleep could have done so in peace in the half of the room which lay in darkness. It was a huge room with 40 beds, while the other in the lighted part could have played at dice or cards and done all the other things for which light was needed. A boy whose bed was in the lighted half of the room and who wanted to sleep could have lain down in one of the vacant beds in the half-dark, for there were always enough beds vacant, and no boy objected to another's making a temporary use of his bed. But it was impossible to stick to this arrangement for even a single night. There would always be a couple of boys, for instance, who had taken advantage of the darkness to snatch some sleep, and then felt inclined for a game of cards on a board stretched between their beds. Naturally enough, they switched on the nearest electric light, which wakened up those who were sleeping with their faces turned towards its glare. Of course, one could swarm away from the light for a while, but in the end the only thing to do was start a game of cards with one's own wakeful neighbor and switch on another light. And that meant pipes going, too, all around. Here and there, to be sure, some determined sleepers, among whom Carl was usually to be counted, burrowed their heads under the pillows instead of lying on top of them. But how was one to keep on sleeping if the boy in the next bed got up in the very middle of the night for a few hours roistering in the town before going on duty, and washed his face with a clatter and much scattering of water at the wash basin fixed at the head of one's own bed? If he not only put on his boots noisily, but even stamped them on the floor to get his feet thoroughly into them. Most of the boy's boots were too narrow, in spite of the shape of American footwear, and if finally, not being able to find some trifle or other to complete his toilet, simply lifted one's pillow off one's face, the pillow beneath which he had of course long given up trying to sleep, and was waiting merely to let fly at him. Now the boys were also great lovers of sport, and most of them young, strong lads who wanted to miss no chance at training their bodies. So if you were startled out of your sleep in the night by an uproar, you were sure to find a boxing match in full career on the floor beside your bed, while expert spectators in shirts and drawers stood on all the beds around about, with every light turned on. It happened once that in such a midnight boxing match, one of the combatants fell over Carl as he was sleeping, and the first thing they saw when opening his eyes was a stream of blood from the boy's nose, which before anything could be done about it, bespattered all the bedclothes. Carl often spent nearly the whole of his 12 hours in trying to get a few hours' sleep. He was strongly enough tempted to take part in the general fun, but then it always came into his mind that the others had gained a better start in life, and that he must catch up to them by harder work and a little renunciation. So, although he was eager to get sufficient sleep, chiefly on account of his work, he complained neither to the manageress nor Therese about the conditions in the dormitory, for all the other boys suffered in the same way without really grumbling about it. And besides, the tribulations of the dormitory were a necessary part of the job which he had gratefully accepted from the hands of the manageress. Once a week, On changing from day to night duty, he had a free period of 24 hours, part of which he devoted to seeing the manageress once or twice and exchanging a few words with Therese, usually in some corner or other in a corridor, very rarely indeed in her room, whenever he caught her off duty for a moment or two. Sometimes, too, he escorted her on her errands to the town, which all had to be executed at top speed. They would rush to the nearest underground station, almost at a run, Carl carrying the basket. The journey flashed past in a second, as if the train were being pulled through a vacuum, and then they were already getting out and clattering up the stairs at the other end without waiting for the lift, which was too slow for them. Then the great squares appeared, from which the streets rayed out star fashion, bringing a tumult of steady, streaming traffic from every side. But Carl and Therese stuck close together and hurried to the different offices, laundries, warehouses, and shops to do the errands which could not easily be attended to by telephone, mostly purchases of a minor nature or trifling complaints. Therese soon noticed that Carl's assistance was not to be despised, indeed that in many cases it greatly expedited matters. In his company she had never to stand waiting, as at other times, for the overdriven shopkeepers to attend her. He marched up to the counter and rapped on it with his knuckles until someone came. In his newly acquired and still somewhat pedantic English, easy to distinguish from 100 other accents, he shouted across high walls of human beings. He went up to people without hesitation, even if they were haughtily withdrawn into the recesses of the longest shops. He did all this not out of arrogance, nor from any lack of respect for difficulties, but because he felt himself in a secure position which gave him certain rights. The Hotel Occidental was not to be despised as a customer, and after all, Therese sorely needed help in spite of her business experience. "You should always come with me," she often said, laughing happily, when they returned from a particularly successful expedition. During the month and a half that Carl stayed at Ramsay's, he was only thrice in Therese's room for long visits of a few hours at a time. It was naturally smaller than the manageress's room. The few things in it were crowded round the window, but after his experiences in the dormitory, Carl could appreciate the value of a private, relatively quiet room, and though he never expressly said so, Therese could see how much he liked being there. She had no secrets from him, and indeed it would not have been very easy to keep secrets from him after that visit of hers on the first night. She was an illegitimate child. Her father was a foreman mason who had sent for her and her mother from Pomerania. But as if that had been his whole duty, or as if the work-worn woman and the sickly child whom he met at the landing stage had disappointed his expectations, had gone off to Canada without much explanation shortly after their arrival, and they had received neither a letter nor any other word from him, which indeed was not wholly surprising, for they were lost beyond discovery among the tenements in the East End of New York. On one occasion, Therese told Carl, he was standing beside her at the window looking down at the street, of her mother's death. How her mother and she one winter evening, she must have been about 5 then, were hurrying through the streets, each carrying a bundle, to find some shelter for the night. How her mother had at first taken her hand. There was a snowstorm, and it was not easy to make headway, until her own hand grew numb and she let Therese go without even looking to see what had become of her, so that the child had to make shift to hang on by herself to her mother's skirts. Often Therese stumbled and even fell, but her mother seemed to be beyond herself and went on without stopping. And what snowstorms you got in the long, straight streets of New York! Carl had no experience of what winter in New York was like. If you walked against the wind, which kept whirling around and round, you could not open your eyes even for a minute. The wind lashed the snow into your face all the time. You walked and walked, but got no farther forward. It was enough to make you desperate. A child naturally was at an advantage compared with a grown-up. It could duck under the wind, and even get through, and even find a little pleasure in the struggle. So that night, Therese was hardly able to understand her mother's situation, and she was now firmly convinced that if she had only acted then more wisely towards her mother, of course she was a very little girl, her mother might not have had to die such a wretched death. Her mother had had no work at all for 2 days. Her last coin was gone. They had passed the day in the open without a bite, and the bundles they carried contained nothing but useless odds and ends, which, perhaps out of superstition, they did not dare to throw away. There was a prospect of work the very next morning at a new building, but Teresa's mother was afraid, as she had tried to explain the whole day, that she might not be able to take advantage of the chance, for she felt dead tired inside, and that very moment had coughed up a great deal of blood in the street, to the alarm of passers-by. Her only wish was to get some place where she could be warm and rest. And just that evening, it was impossible to find even a corner, Sometimes a janitor would not even let them inside a doorway of a building, where they might at least have sheltered a little from the cold. But if they did get past the janitor, they scurried through the oppressive, icy corridors, climbed countless stairs, circled narrow balconies overlooking courtyards, beating upon doors at random, at one moment not daring to speak to anyone, and at another imploring everyone they met. And once or twice her mother had sat down breathlessly on a step in some quiet stairway, drew Therese, who was almost reluctant, to her breast, and kissed her with painful insistence on the lips. When Therese realized afterwards that these were her mother's last kisses, she did not understand how she could have been so blind as to not know it, small creature though she was. Some of the doors they passed stood open to let out a stifling funk. In the smoky reek which filled these rooms, as if they were on fire, nothing could be discerned but some figure looming in the doorway who discouraged them, either by stolid silence or by a curt word, from expecting accommodation within. On looking back, Therese thought it was only in the first few hours that her mother was really seeking for a place of shelter, for after about midnight she spoke to no one at all, although she was on her feet with brief interruptions until dawn. And although these tenements never locked their doors all night, and there was a constant traffic of people whom she could not help meeting, of course they were not actually running about from place to place, but they were moving as fast as their strength would permit, perhaps in reality at a kind of crawling shuffle. And Therese could not tell whether between midnight and 5 o'clock in the morning they had been in 20 buildings or in 2, or only in 1. The corridors of these tenements were cunningly contrived to save space, but not make it easy to find one's way about. Likely enough, they had trailed again and again through the same corridor. Therese had a dim recollection of emerging from the door of a house which they had been traversing endlessly, only to turn back, or so it seemed to her, when they had reached the street and plunge again into it. For a child like her, it was, of course, an incomprehensible torture to be dragged along, sometimes holding her mother's hand, sometimes clutching to her skirts, without a single word of comfort, and in her bewilderment, the only explanation she could find was that her mother wanted to run away from her. So, for safety's sake, Therese clutched all the more firmly at her mother's skirts with one hand, even when her mother was holding her by the other hand, and sobbed at intervals. She did not want to be left behind among these people who were stamping up the stairs before them, or came behind them, invisibly, round the next turn of the stairway below, people who stood quarreling in the corridors before a door and pushed each other into it by turns. Drunk men wandered about the place dolefully singing, and Therese's mother was lucky to slip with her through their hands, which almost barred the way. At such a late hour of night, when no one was paying much attention to anything, and rights were no longer insisted on, she could have certainly codged a place in one of the common doss houses run by private owners, several of which they passed, but Therese was unaware of this, and her mother was past all thought of resting. Morning found them, at the dawn of a fine winter day, both leaning against a house wall. Perhaps they had slept for a little while there. Perhaps only stared about them with open eyes. It appeared that Therese had lost her bundle, and her mother made to beat her as a punishment for her negligence, but Therese neither heard nor felt any blow. Then they went on again through the wakening streets, Therese's mother next to the wall. They crossed a bridge where her mother's hand brushed rime from the railing, and at length, Therese accepted it as a matter of course at the time, but now she could not understand it. They fetched up at the very building where her mother had been asked to report that morning. She did not tell Therese whether to wait or go away, and Therese took this as a command to wait, since that was what she preferred to do. So she sat down on a heap of bricks, and looked on while her mother undid her bundle, took out a gay scrap of metal, and bound it round the headcloth which she had been wearing all night. Therese was too tired even to think of helping her mother. Without giving her name at the foreman's office, as was customary, without inquiring of anyone, her mother began to climb a ladder, as if she already knew the task that was allotted to her. Therese was surprised at this, since the hod woman usually worked on ground level, mixing the lime, carrying the bricks, and performing other simple duties. So she thought that her mother was going to do some better paid kind of work today, and sleepily smiled up to her. The building was not very high yet. It had hardly reached the first story, though the tall scaffolding for the rest of the structure, still without its connecting boards, rose up into the blue sky. Reaching to the top of the wall, her mother skillfully skirted round the bricklayers, who went on stolidly setting brick on brick, and for some incomprehensible reason paid no attention to her. With gentle fingers, she felt her way cautiously along a wooden partition which served as a railing, and Therese, dozing below, was amazed at such skill and fancied that her mother glanced at her kindly. But in her course, her mother now came to a little heap of bricks, beyond which the railing, and obviously also the wall, came to an end. But she did not stop for that, but walked straight onto the heap of bricks, and there her skill seemed to desert her, for she knocked down the bricks and fell sheer over them to the ground. A shower of bricks came after her, and then, a good minutes later, a heavy plank detached itself from somewhere and crashed down upon her. Teresa's last memory of her mother was seeing her lying there in her checkered skirt, which had come all the way from Pomerania, her legs thrown wide, almost covered by the rough plank atop her, while people came running up from every side and a man shouted down angrily from the top of the wall. It was late when Therese finished her story. She had told it with a wealth of detail unusual for her, and notably at quite unimportant passages, such as when she described the scaffolding poles, each rising up to the heaven by itself, she had been compelled to stop now and then with tears in her eyes. The most trifling circumstance of that morning was still stamped exactly on her memory after more than 10 years, and because the sight of her mother on the half-finished house wall was the last living memory of her mother, and she wanted to bring it still more vividly before her friend, she tried to return to it again after she had ended her story, but then she faltered, put her face in her hands, and said not another word. Still, they had merry hours, too, in Teresa's room. On the first visit, Carl had seen a textbook of commercial correspondence lying there, and asked leave to borrow it. They arranged at the same time that Carl should write out the exercises in the book and bring them to Therese, who had already studied them, as far as her own work required, for correction. Now Carl lay for whole nights in his bed in the dormitory with cotton wool in his ears, shifting into every conceivable posture to relax himself, and read the book and scribble the exercises in a little notebook with a fountain pen which the managers had given him in reward for drawing up methodically and writing out neatly a long inventory of hers. He managed to turn to his advantage most of the distracting interruptions of the other boys by perpetually asking them for advice on small points of the English language, so that they grew tired of it and left him in peace. Often he was amazed that the others were so reconciled to their present lot that they did not feel its provisional character nor even realize the need to come to a decision about their future occupations, and in spite of Carl's example, read nothing at all except tattered and filthy copies of detective stories which were passed from bed to bed. At their conferences, Therese now corrected Carl's exercises perhaps rather too painstakingly. Differences of opinion arose. Carl adducted his great New York professor in his support, but that gentleman counted for as little with Therese as the grammatical theories of the lift boys. She would take the fountain pen from Carl's hand and score out the passages which she was convinced were erroneous. But in such dubious cases, although the matter could hardly be brought before a higher authority than Therese, Carl would score out, for the sake of accuracy, the strokes which Therese had made against him. Sometimes the manageress would turn up and give the decision in Therese's favor, yet that was not definite, as Therese was her secretary. At the same time, however, she would establish a general amnesty, for tea would be made, cake sent for, and Carl urged to tell stories about Europe, with many interruptions from the manageress, who kept inquiring and exclaiming so that he realized how many things had been radically changed in a relatively short time, and how much probably had changed since his own departure and would always go on changing. Carl might have been about a month in Ramsey's when, one evening, Reynolds said to him in passing that a man called Delmarche had stopped him in front of the hotel and questioned him about Carl. Having no cause to make a secret of it, Reynolds had replied truthfully that Carl was a lift boy, but had prospects of getting a much better post because of the interest the manageress took in him. Carl noted how carefully Delmarche had handled Reynolds, for he had actually invited him to a meal that evening. "I want nothing more to do with Delmarche," said Carl, "and you'd better be on your guard against him, too." "Me?" said Reynolds, stretching himself and hurrying off. He was the best-looking youngster in the hotel, and it was rumored among the other boys that no one knew who had started the story that a fashionable lady who had been staying in the hotel for some time had kissed him, to say the least of it, in the lift. Those who knew this rumor found it very titillating to watch the self-possessed lady passing by with her calm, light step, her filmy veil and tightly laced figure, for her external appearance gave not the slightest indication that such behavior was possible on her part. She stayed on the first floor, which was not served by Reynolds' lift, but one could not, of course, forbid guests enter another lift if their own lifts were engaged at the moment. So now and then it happened that she used Carl's and Reynolds' lift, yet only when Reynolds was on duty. This might have been by chance, but nobody believed it, and when the lift started off with the two of them, there was an almost uncontrollable excitement among the lift boys which actually made it necessary for one head waiter to intervene. Now, whether the lady or the rumor was the cause, the fact remained that Reynolds was changing. He had become much more self-confident. He left the polishing of the lift entirely to Carl, who was only waiting for the chance of a radical explanation on this point, and no longer was to be seen in the dormitory. No other boys had so completely deserted the community of the lift boys, for at least in questions concerning their work, they generally held strictly together and had an organization of their own which was recognized by the hotel management. All this flashed through Carl's mind, together with reflections on Delmarche, but he went on with his work as usual. Towards midnight, he had a little diversion for Therese, who often surprised him with small gifts, brought him a big apple and a bar of chocolate. They talked together for a while, scarcely conscious of the interruptions caused by the lift journeys. They came to speak of Delmarche, and Carl realized that he must really have let himself be influenced by Therese in coming to the conclusion that he was a dangerous man, for after what Carl had told her, that was Therese's opinion of him. Carl himself believed that he was only a shiftless creature who had let himself be demoralized by ill luck and would be easily enough to get on with, but Therese contradicted him violently and in a long harangue insisted that he should promise never to speak to Delmarche again. Instead of giving the promise, Carl kept urging to her to go to bed, for midnight was long since past, and when she refused, he threatened to leave his post and take her to her room. When at last she was ready to go, he said, "Why bother yourself so needlessly, Therese? If it will make you sleep any better, I'm ready to promise that I won't speak to Delmarche unless I can't avoid it." Then came a crowd of passengers, for the boy in the neighboring lift had been withdrawn for some other duty, and Carl had to attend both lifts. Some of the guests grumbled at the dislocation, and a gentleman who was escorting a lady actually tapped Carl lightly with his walking cane to make him hurry, an admonition that was quite unnecessary. It would have not been so bad if the guests, when they saw that one lift was unattended, had made directly for Carl's lift, but instead of that they drifted to the next lift and stood there holding the handle of the door, or even walked right into the lift, an act which the lift boys were expressly forbidden by the regulations to permit in any circumstances. So Carl had to rush up and down until he was quite exhausted, without earning the consciousness that he was efficiently fulfilling his duty. On top of this, towards 3 o'clock in the morning, a luggage porter, an old man with whom he was on fairly friendly terms, asked some slight help from him which he could not give, for guests were standing before both his lifts, and it required all his presence of mind to decide immediately which group to take first. He was consequently relieved when the other boy came back, and he called out a few words of reproach to him because he had stayed away so long, although it was probably no fault of his. After 4 o'clock, a lull set in, which Carl badly needed. He leant wearily against the balustrade beside his lift, slowly eating the apple, which gave out a strong fragrance as soon as he bit into it, and gazed down into a lighted shaft surrounded by the great windows of the storerooms, behind which hanging masses of bananas gleamed faintly in the darkness.